up signs that read mass deportation now.
As a guy who spent 34 years deporting illegal aliens, I got a message to the millions of illegal aliens that Joe Biden's released in our country in violation of federal law. You better start packing now. You're damn right. Because you're going home.
So that's Tom Homan. Tell us more about who he is. I mean, if you look at him over the last 4 years after Trump, he appears on increasingly right-wing podcasts, anti-Semitic, pro-Nazi podcasts. They're just remarkable. But he is defiant, even in the 60 Minutes piece that we played before, in saying the way to keep families together is to deport them all, those who are legal and those who are undocumented.
Yes. So Homan is the intellectual father of the family separation policy and one of the contributors to Project 2025. He has said no one is off the table. So his appointment really shows that Trump's immigration policies moving forward and his mass deportations, which are a big part of that, are not solely or even principally going to be focused on criminals. They're going to be focused on undocumented families, on women and children who have homes here, who have jobs here. And I think one of the most important things that I want to underscore here is that during the first Trump administration, when Homan was at the head of ICE, what they did was they shifted the focus from serious human trafficking and terrorism investigations to the obsessive deportation of women and children who are in the United States without authorization. There's two main components to ICE. There's the ERO division, the Enforcement and Removal Operations Division, which is focused on rounding up families. And then there's the Homeland Security's Investigations Unit, which is focused on serious threats to Homeland Security. And as I report in my book, HSI, the Serious Homeland Security Division, was sidelined for ERO, so for these roundups of immigrant families who pose no threat to this country and who, in fact, are the backbone of the United States economy and are our neighbors and are, in many cases, you know, our family members, our friends. And so ultimately, I think what this shows is that when you look at who these people are, these guys are bullies. That is ultimately what they are. They like to beat up on vulnerable people. And that is what Trump's immigration policy going forth is going to be. Now that we know that Stephen Miller is going to be in charge of, deputy chief of staff of policy. And now that we know that Thomas Homan is also going to be playing this fundamental role.
Jean Guidetto, we want to thank you for being with us, New York Times contributing opinion writer, author of the book Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Incoming President Trump's vow to deport millions of immigrants when he starts his term has sent private prison stocks soaring. In an earnings call with investors Thursday, GEO Group CEO Brian Robert Evans and chairperson George Zoli hailed what they called an unprecedented opportunity.
We expect the incoming Trump administration to take a much more aggressive approach regarding border security as well as interior enforcement and to request additional funding from Congress to achieve these goals. We stand ready to provide additional services and resources to help ICE meet its future needs.
Great. And then, you know, there was some additional talk about the air services contract. I think that's $25 million in annualized revenue. You know, I think we have a pretty good idea of the potential size of the detention and the ICE program in the new administration. But could you help us try to size this air services opportunity? And then what kind of margins do you generate in that business?
You know, I think to speak in generalities, we're looking at a theoretical potential doubling of all of our services, whether it's in the detention segment, in the transportation segment, as well as the ISAP program. Of course, this will depend on Congress providing the required funding.
For more on how both the private prison corporations and immigrant rights advocates are preparing for the incoming Trump administration, we're joined by Silky Shah, executive director of Detention Watch Network, author of Unbuild Walls, Why Immigrant Justice Needs Abolition. Her new article for Truth Out is headlined, Trump 2.0 poses an even bigger threat to migrants. Here's how we fight back. Silky, welcome back to Democracy Now! So earlier, we played the clip of Stephen Miller, one of the top people to be in charge of what Trump is calling largest deportation campaign in U.S. history. He says, seal the borders. He says, detain people. They're talking about on military bases and building other detention sites. And then fly them out. And we're hearing from GEO Group right now. Put this all together.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we've heard, and thank you so much for having me, what we've heard so much over the last year and since Project 2025 came out, and, you know, in so many ways, the first sort of Trump campaign was defined by the border wall, and this one is really defined by mass deportations. And we actually have experience of an era when we had mass deportations, especially in recent memory. Under the Obama administration, this is what we saw, some 400,000 people being deported within the interior of the country, people currently living in the U.S. often being deported through a lot of sort of relationships with local sheriffs, with contracts with county jails, with expansion of contracts with private prison companies, which we've just seen expand as both, you know, during Bush, Obama, Trump, and Biden. We've just seen private prison companies take over even more and more of immigration detention. And so it's going to be, it's, you know, local police, ICE agents, CBP agents. There's so many different entities involved that are going to, you know, are going to be a part of the sort of mass deportation agenda that Trump is putting out there. And I think that is both terrifying, but also something that we fought back against before. And we have to sort of prepare ourselves to start sort of throwing the wrenches in that strategy now.
And Silky Shah, you mentioned that we've had this experience before with the Obama administration, but this has been a regular feature of the American economy and American capitalism now for much longer. I'm going back to the 1930s with the mass deportations under President Hoover and 1950s under President Eisenhower with Operation Wetback. And even in the Bush administration, obviously, with the workplace raids that occurred after the immigrant protests of 2006 that swept across the country. And yet the undocumented population continues to grow despite all of these dragnets that the federal government periodically gets into. Wondering your sense of what the more correct or judicious approach of the federal government should be toward surges in immigration.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to understand that often what happens whenever there are moments of, like we're in right now, of economic insecurity, of sort of depletion of social safety nets, there is this sort of scapegoating that happens to immigrant communities. We saw it both from the Republicans this election cycle. We also saw it from the Democrats this election cycle, where they really abandoned a pro-immigrant stance, which is so concerning, and which is going to make our sort of strategy to fight back against this mass deportation agenda that much harder. But I, you know, what we saw, especially under the Obama administration, when we fought those mass deportations, there was a lot of ways to sort of intervene. And one was through sanctuary policy. We had local and state level officials, and then this expanded even during Trump, where more and more sanctuary policies passed and protected immigrant communities from deportation. And Obama was even compelled, because of the outrage around mass deportations, to implement things like deferred action for childhood arrivals and temporary protected status for millions of people, many of whom who will now be potentially subject to deportation and family separation in the coming years. And so I do think there are a lot of opportunities to provide relief for communities, to create legal pathways for people who want to come, to stop this sort of manufactured and created chaos at the border, and instead of this sort of enforcement-only approach that we've seen in immigration for decades.
And do you have a sense of what potentially President Biden could still do in his last months in office to somehow or other provide relief for some of the migrants?
Absolutely. I mean, there are several requests for proposals, information for new detention centers around the country, 7-8 detention centers. And what we know is that one of the ways that that deportation is facilitated is by having detention capacity. This is one of the reasons we argue for shutting down detention centers. When you take a detention center away from a community, people are less likely to be targeted in that community. And so we are asking the Biden administration to rescind those contracts immediately, start shutting down facilities now, facilities that could easily be shut down today. They have a lot of power to do that and sort of make it harder for the Trump administration to put these new contracts in place, and also to release people from detention. Many people are vulnerable. Detention is completely up to the discretion of ICE. They can easily release people and let them be in community, get the services that they need, get the legal support they need so that they can go through their immigration proceedings not in detention. We also really, you know, the president has a lot of ability to have presidential pardons. So many of the people who are caught up in ICE detention have past criminal convictions for which they've already been in the criminal legal system for, and sort of applying those pardons, you know, clemency at the state level, other things that we can do to make it so people aren't subject to the mass deportation agenda. And we know the Trump administration and Trump has really been focusing on that sort of quote unquote, like focusing on quote unquote criminals. And that is what we're going to see. We're going to see them working with local sheriffs, and we need to do everything we can to sort of make sure that the criminal legal system isn't used again for this mass deportation roundup.
Silky Shah, we want to thank you so much for being with us, speaking to us from Bellingham, Washington, Executive Director of Detention Watch Network. We'll link to your Truth Out piece. Trump 2.0 poses an even bigger threat to migrants. Here's how we fight back. Coming up, American Coup, Wilmington, 1898. A new PBS film is premiering tonight on white supremacists in North Carolina who carried out a massacre and a coup to overthrow the elected government in a black-majority city. Back in 20 seconds.
They'll look high and they'll look low.
They'll look everywhere we go.
But when the sinners find us, we won't hide. They'll come loud and they'll come fast.
We shoot first and we can last.
Keep your rifle by your side. Singing, oh Lord, this earth was made for us. Singing, oh Lord, this sinful life just ain't enough. So we'll take a stand, 'cause we must protect our land. Keep your rifle by your side.
Keep your rifle by your side. The Hope County Choir. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. A new film is premiering tonight on PBS on the largely erased history of a coup to overthrow the elected government of the black-majority North Carolina city of Wilmington, 3 decades after the Civil War. This is the trailer for American Coup, Wilmington, 1898.
As thoroughly, as completely as it captured in battle.
It was the only armed overthrow of an elected government.
We really don't know how many people were murdered that day.
Whole families have broken up and scattered. The homes representing their savings are deserted.
I've always felt like this story was always meant to be told.
In North
Carolina, the Negro holds the balance of power. There was really no other major city in the South like Wilmington.
You have the black leadership with college degrees.
And there was a professional class there, doctors and teachers and lawyers.
White vendors are having to compete with black vendors for customers. And black men are able to hold public office at multiple levels of government. Wilmington is essentially a promised land for African Americans.
It was a different vision of what American democracy could be, that it could actually be multiracial and work.
Men, do your duty. This city, county, and state shall be rid of Negro domination once and forever.
The Confederacy was trying to take power back.
And white supremacy is going to be the rallying cry.
So leaders of the conspiracy turned to actually taking over the city government at gunpoint.
A definition of a coup d'etat is an armed overthrow of a legally elected government, which is what happened on this day in Wilmington.
This was a coup based on the devaluation of African-American citizenship. You think about the loss of wealth, the stealing of their generational legacies. What Wilmington tells us is how fragile American democracy is.
The trailer for American Coup, Wilmington, 1898. We're going to speak to the director, but first, this clip lays out how Wilmington was the largest city in North Carolina in 1898. Black people held many positions in government alongside white people.
The removal of troops from the South ushered in the end of Reconstruction, and white supremacists are once again able to regain power.
Democrats and Republicans of 1898 are not the Democrats and Republicans of the 21st century.
Remember, what we had coming out of the Civil War was that Lincoln was a Republican, and the Republican Party was founded on an anti-slavery platform.
Meant that most African American voters were going to vote for the Republican candidates.
The Democrats were the Klan members. The Democrats were the slave owners, the enslavers. They were deeply committed to denying citizenship rights to African Americans.
The Democratic Party holds the state in the 1870s. Throughout the 1880s. It's really not until the 1890s that you begin to see the Democrats again lose their power. There's a depression that takes place in 1893. White farmers are suffering.
These white farmers felt that the Democratic Party was beholden to the banks and the railroads and the moneyed interests.
And they bolt from the Democrats and join the populists, which is a third party.
Neither the Republican Party nor the Populist Party had the voting power to unseat Democratic Party candidates if they were running in a tripartite election.
So they form an alliance, white populists and black and white Republicans. This became known as fusion.
We see a political alliance between African Americans and working class white people.
The populists were as racist as any of the members of the Democratic Party, but their economic interests were so strong that they were able to set that aside.
It's not some kumbaya moment. We've got to be really clear about that. It was a pragmatic moment.
So both in 1894 and in 1896, this fusionist coalition of black and white men are able to sweep the North Carolina General Assembly.
North Carolina elects a fusion governor, Daniel Russell. They send George White to Congress, and they start to pull back all the things that the Democrats did to reduce democracy. So, for example, the positions that were once appointed in Wilmington are now turned into elected positions, which allows black people to run for office.
It created really a situation in Wilmington that was unique. You had black men in positions of authority and power.
So we see black and white men on the board of aldermen. We see black and white men serving in various municipal offices.
10 of the 26 policemen were black men. The city treasurer, the city jailer, the city coroner.
John C. Dancy was the custom collector at the port, which is a federally appointed position. He made $4,000 a year, which is $1,000 more than the governor made.
The mayor of Wilmington is also a fusion candidate. It's not the majority of black, it's the majority fusion that makes a difference.
So with Wilmington by 1898, African Americans had still held on to a lot of the rights and privileges and the institutions and the power they had enjoyed.
It was a land of possibility, a land of hope, a different vision of what American democracy could be, that it could actually be multiracial and work.
That last voice, Carol Anderson, Emory professor. And this is another clip from American Coup Wilmington 1898 that describes an editorial in Wilmington's black newspaper, The Daily Record, before the coup.
Rebecca Felton, she was the wife of a congressman in Georgia. She gave a speech to the Agricultural Society condemning white men for, in her mind, not doing enough to stop the black beast rapists and this supposed rape epidemic in Georgia. There was no rape epidemic, but she created one. White supremacist newspapers in Wilmington realized they could make something of this. So they reprinted her speech in August of 1898. And as soon as Alex Manley saw that, he sat down and wrote an editorial in response to Mrs. Felton.
Mrs. Felton from Georgia makes a speech before the Agricultural Society at Tybee, Georgia, in which she advocates lynching as an extreme measure.
Experience among poor white people in the country teaches us that women of that race are not more particular in the matter of clandestine meetings with colored men than are the white men with colored women. Meetings of this kind go on for some time until the women's infatuation or the man's boldness brings attention to them, and the man is lynched for rape. Every Negro lynched is called a big, burly black brute, when in fact, many of those who have thus been dealt with had white men for their fathers and were not only not black and burly, but were sufficiently attractive for the white girls of culture and refinement to fall in love with them.
Tell your men that it is no worse for a black man to be intimate with a white woman than for a white man to be intimate with a colored woman. Don't think ever that your women will remain pure while you are debauching ours. Alex Manley editorial, Daily Record, August 18th, 1898.
This was blasphemous, you know, to say that a white woman could actually desire a black man. What?
The other point he made was that for generations, white men had been raping black women with impunity, and that had been going on forever, and nobody talks about that.
Alexander Manley's rebuttal to Rebecca Felton was absolutely courageous. He didn't say it behind closed doors while he's talking with his friends. He did it in an editorial published in the Daily Record that has white advertisers. And so he's really putting himself out there. You have some members of the black community who are like, oh, Manley doesn't speak for us.
There were many who perhaps, even if they believed it was true, thought that it was, you know, too inflammatory to be printed. We also see prominent black men in Wilmington urge Manley to recant the editorial, to apologize in an effort to avoid conflict. He refuses. He sees himself as someone who has done nothing wrong. He has spoken a truth that he believes has gone unspoken for too long.
American Coup, Wilmington, 1898, premieres tonight on PBS and will also stream online. We're joined by the co-director, Yoruba Richin, award-winning filmmaker. Yoruba, welcome back to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. Thanks for having me.
And Yoruba, I wanted to start off by asking you that the Manley editorial became the basis for the first attack of the white supremacists when they burned down the newspaper. You talk about, and again, they were spurred on by the editor and publisher of the white-owned News and Observer. Talk about the role of that publisher as well.
Absolutely. The editorial that we just saw was used as the spark to go into action. But this coup had been planned meticulously in the months leading up to it. It was planned by a group called the Secret Nine, otherwise known as the Chamber, you know, very prominent members of the Chamber of Commerce. They were self-styled, self-called white supremacists. And it was led by Josephus Daniels, who was the editor of the News and Observer in Raleigh. And the newspaper had published continually this idea, this racist idea of black men raping white women and of bad government that Negroes were in charge of. And that if we continued, you know, if they continued to let this happen, white women would be debased and continue to be rape, an epidemic of rape. And that's what you saw, you know, the Rebecca Felton newspaper, her speech reprinted in the newspaper, and Manley responding and saying, no, that's not true, and debunking that. And it was that editorial that they said, you know, look what happens when Negroes are in rule. Look at the things that they can say. We got to get rid of them. We got to get rid of this newspaper. And that was the spur for the attack. But it had been planned many, you know, months before the actual events happened.
And in making the film, you not only went into the archival records, but you made a decision to locate and interview both white and black descendants of families that were involved in the events at the time. Could you talk about that?
Absolutely. My co-director and I, that was one of the first things that we knew we wanted to include in the film. We were we found out that a group of black descendants and really one white descendant had been meeting for about a year before we started the production through an organization called Coming to the Table, which is a national organization that deals, that brings blacks and whites together dealing with racial issues. And they had been meeting, and we were able to, you know, meet them through that organization, attend those meetings, and start to create a relationship with the some of the descendants who you see in the film. And then we did work to find more descendants, particularly more white descendants, because they were harder to locate or to invite to come and be a part of the film. And we're very grateful for
and
their
one
participation.
One of the white descendants was the descendant of the newspaper
Absolutely,
editor, right? And
yes.
He and his and the other descendants took down his statue.
Yes, yes. So the News and Observer, up until the 1960s, was the paper that we saw in 1890s. And then there was a change. And the family recently took down the statue, I think in about 2020. And, you know, Frank was a part of it. He is in the film admitting to what his ancestor did and the harm that it produced, not only to North Carolina, but to the nation.
And what happened, actually? What did all of this lead up to? How many people died?
So, you know, we'll never know the numbers, the exact numbers. They weren't, you know, they weren't taking it down. But it's said that it was maybe 200 to 300, but it was probably more than that, you can imagine. Black people ran into the swamps. One of the, Alfred Waddell, one of the leaders, said, we'll choke the Cape Fear with their bodies.
We have 10 seconds.
And then it returned to, then it became a majority white city. And 2 years later, Jim Crow was instituted, and there was not another black person elected from the state of North Carolina till 1992.
Wow. It is an amazing film, and I encourage people to watch it. It premieres tonight on PBS and also live streams. Yoruba Richin is co-director of American Coup, Wilmington, 1898. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. This is Democracy Now!